Music City, Nashville, Tennessee. Two verses and a chorus shy of a hit song. Here they are. It's Scott and it's Hino.
And the Music Road Show.
All right, welcome back. That's exactly. And too much fun over here. We're so glad that you stuck around with us during that very, very long commercial break.
We're talking about Minnie Mouse hair buns, everybody.
Yeah, that's exactly what we're talking about.
Welcome to the hair show here on WSM.
Well, you guys definitely have the wrong guess if you're talking about hair. Come on, man.
Well, anyway, we are here with the great Steve Warner. If you're just joining us, Scott, man, why don't you give us a quick recap?
Well, before I do, I want to let people know that if they want to join in the conversation, go to themusicrowshow.com. I'm sorry, go to facebook.com/themusicrowshow and just throw in a little question here if you want, or comment if you're enjoying it. We're hearing from some of you. And yeah, we're here with Steve Warner, whose latest album came out in October, all over the map. It was October, right?
It was end of October, yep.
And then the holidays came, and it just took us forever to get him in here, but we're so excited. This is a great CD. We haven't even talked about where one can find this CD. Where do you get it?
Well, your usual places, I think, you know, iTunes. Mm-hmm. Our website, stevewarner.com, of course.
And yep.
I would say Spotify and iTunes, all those usual digital outlets, you know?
Yeah, but if they want a physical copy,
my trunk.
Go to your shows, right?
Absolutely.
Yeah, definitely, yeah.
So we were talking right before the break about instrumentals, and how tempting is it to hold back on showing off technique versus, you know, creating memorable melody lines, that kind of thing? Because a lot of times when you hear instrumentals in other genres, it's like, hey, look how fast I can play, like, yeah, all the time. You know?
I tell you what, man, that's a great question, because I feel like some people do that. You know, you listen to records and you go, man.
And it's cool for a minute.
Yeah, but you know what? There's a saying, and I wish I could paraphrase that in the right way, but basically just because you can play all those notes don't mean you should play all those notes, you know? It seems like I always refer back to, and I know people listening to me that somewhat follow me probably get so tired of me talking about Chet Atkins all the time, but I learned so much from him. That's a great example of something here. His restraint was so incredible. And Chet could play with the best. He could play fast and do those flourishes, but I watched him do it so many times in so many years. He waited to the right moment. It's kind of like Michael Jordan to me in a lot of ways. Michael Jordan waited to the right moments to, or Tom Brady, if you want,
right,
if you will, you know, waited to the right moment to
the end.
He
could
mash the pedal down when he wanted to, but he waited to the right time when it meant the most. And I heard Chet once listening to someone that was playing a fast solo, and he just goes, "Huh, it sounds like they're getting paid by the note." So I mean, but you're right about that. It's tempting sometimes, because maybe if you do have the chops that you could play all this blazing stuff. But, you know, sometimes Reggie Young has always been an inspiration to me. And I used to watch him on my sessions and hear him on other folks' records. Reggie Young, for most folks would know who I'm speaking of, but he's one of the greatest players on the planet and played on so many hit records. My favorite intro he did was Drift Away. That was his intro.
All right.
Of Dobie Gray's record Drift Away, among many, many others, but he, I always watched him in a session, and he might just play a few little licks, and then every now and then he would step out and do these cool little things. He knew exactly the right little place to put them, you know, and that's a real art in itself, is having that restraint and knowing when to mash the pedal down when you want to, you know. And of course, then you have the chops to be able to back it up.
Well, too, yeah, there's a time for that. Yeah.
Exactly, you pick the right time to do it. Yeah. So that's a wonderful point and good question.
What was it? It was Vince Gill that came in, and he talked about his first session.
Oh yeah,
first time he got to play on a session, and it came time for him to do the solo, and he just played this amazing solo, you know, he thought, and the engineer turned off and said, "Well, son, that was real fine. Now this time play again and don't play everything you know." It's like, yep.
Well, Vince is such a great player. He can play lots of cool stuff. He is one of those guys that definitely has the chops.
Well, I got a question for you about over the years. You were involved RCA, then MCA, and then Capitol, I think. But there were several labels over many, many years of playing. And often when you went from one to another, there was a surge for you, a spike in in hits and sales and stuff. What were the deciding factors as an artist to leave one for another, and how scary was that first time to go from RCA to MCA?
You guys, man, you're asked the right stuff. That's good, man. I think a lot of times there's a feeling that you know when it's like when I left MCA, we were on great terms. I was doing good. You could check me, but I think we had 10 number ones in a row or something crazy like that. We were on a real big roll there. But, you know, for me in my career, at that point in my career, I was having radio success big time, but I was not, my record sales were not equal to, they weren't on par with what my success at radio was.
Yeah.
And so it was always a challenge for me. I was lucky that, and I was writing a lot of those. I really came into my writing at MCA. I wrote a lot of, my first number one record that I wrote was on around that time. It was a song I wrote with John Hall called You Can Dream of Me. And so I really got on a roll writing a lot of stuff. But, you know, you kind of get the feeling. So when your contract is coming up, and you know, an artist kind of, you know, you kind of
is it like a enthusiasm? Like you're not feeling enthusiasm from the team, or
well, the thing of it is, and artists that are on labels and have been there, they know what I'm speaking of here. They'll know this, but the label stuff is evolving all the time. It never stays the same. It's like a, it's kind of like a monster that's moving all the time.
Well, the people that brought you in, brought you in are not there anymore.
Exactly. And that evolves all the time. And there's people, you know, like you say, the people that you were associated with may not even be there. They brought in a new president of the label. So you're all constantly having to reprove yourself. And in my case, I was okay because I was with Tony Brown. He was there.
Yeah.
He was, and Jimmy Bowen was producing me. So I was, we were having hit records, man. We were slamming. I mean, we were, but I always wanted for my sales to be, I mean, we were, you know, now I would kill for those record sales. I mean, you know what I'm saying? Nowadays I go, oh my God, I'm not happy with that. We were selling some records, but now you look at, you know,
even the top people aren't selling that.
I mean, I'm telling you, you had to sell gold back then to keep your record deal, you know?
Yeah.
And it's like, you go, are you serious? I mean, there's people now that's, you go, they only sold 68,000.
They sold aluminum.
Oh my God. You know? And that's like, that's a success now,
right,
you know?
Right.
So it's just a, it's kind of like in baseball when you talk about the Mickey Mantle era and the Barry Bonds era. You can't, you can't compare those because it's a whole different world now. But back then, it's like it was always a thing to, you got those record sales. We got to get them. They got to be, you know, it's always a thing about that with me. And I did okay. For, like I say, for now, I did tremendously well.
Right. But why do you think that was? That's such a interesting dichotomy that you'd be really successful here and not
here. I had pockets that I would, Chicago was always a good record sales place for me. Dallas, Fort Worth, Houston, you know, Texas was always huge for me.
Yeah.
And so I had the pockets that were really good, but, and we were touring all the time. I was gone, you know, forever, you know, so we were trying to play those places. You know, but maybe for me, I just, you know, like you say, the people change, artists come and go, the energy might be different than it was when, you know, 2 years prior. And, so it came around a time, like in that case, when when my contract was coming up, it just felt like it was a time to do. And quite honestly, for me, I had an offer from Arista to go with Tim Dubois there. And it was just so fresh. And they were so excited to possibly have me. And I was just, you know, I was in MCA for a long time. So I think that just happens on labels. It's like I say, it's always evolving and you're always having to change my style changed a lot too. I evolved. I mean, became a lot better songwriter through that period. And so it just felt right. In the case of going to MCA, my contract at my previous label had expired, and I had the choice of either re-upping or, and I went with Tony Brown because he had left 3 months prior and went to MCA. And I'm like, as soon as this contract's up, I'm going with Tony Brown. So
yeah.
It was so great working with him. He's a tremendous producer and a great friend. So I just kind of waited my time to go on that one. So you kind of follow what the creative trail is, I think, you know, and what's going to, for me, where the best music kind of seemed to go. So.
Makes sense.
Great. Well, you have so many great guest performers on your new project. We've talked about a few of them already, but like Eric Johnson, for example. I mean, great, great player. Tommy Manuel, Ricky Skaggs, all those guys. I would love to be a fly on the wall when you guys get together. I mean, when players of your caliber get together, are you swapping techniques? I mean, do you still learn things from each other?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I mean, Eric and I went to Austin and recorded Eric Johnson's parts.
Yeah.
He has a studio down there, and we went down there, and I spent a couple of days there, and we were eating out. And we didn't talk guitar as much as we did. We talked guitars, but we didn't talk licks, per se. But we talked, you know, I was with Eric. He was in Nashville about 3 months before we cut that. And I was with him when he bought an old Martin at Carter Guitars.
Oh, wow.
I called, he didn't buy it. I was going to buy it. It was a 1946 D28.
Wow.
I was on the hunt for a D28. And Eric picked one up and it was absolutely unbelievable. He wound up not getting it. And I thought, man, that gets, we were both like just flipping out over this guitar. And I called back at Carter like 2 days later and I knew he left without it. And so I go, well, I'm going to see. I might try it out. And so I called later since he didn't buy it. And they go, oh, no, Eric bought it. He called the next day and said, ship it to us.
Oh, wow.
So we talked about guitars and family. And Eric's a real sweet guy and a dear friend. I've known him for 30 years. And so we really talked about it. He was asking about my boys. You know, my boys worship him. And so we really talked about more of that. We played a little bit together.
Because his playing to me is just so he's the – only player that I've ever heard that can play fast and so smooth at the same time. Just not quite legato, but it's smooth. And it's like, how does he do that? It's amazing.
Well, a lot of classical influences. If you listen to his playing, he plays great classical piano.
Oh, okay.
He's really a good piano player. I mean, an incredible piano player.
Yeah.
In fact, he's playing on that track on my record. We were in the studio listening to his playback and he's real soft-spoken, real gentle, kind-hearted guy. And he says, I think I hear a piano part on that, I think. If you want to, I'll show you if you want. And we walked out in the studio, and there's a Steinway, beautiful old Steinway sitting there. And that came from Berkeley, actually. It came out of Berkeley. And he said, here's the part I was thinking of. And he played these, and I just go, holy cow, that's an awesome part. It was very well thought out. You could tell. It didn't just pop in his mind just then. Probably, or maybe it did, but he knew right where he wanted to put it. So I looked at the engineer and said,
roll it,
put that in record, please.
Yeah.
And he did these parts and he played piano on it too.
Man.
But he's a thinker, man. He's really great parts, smart parts. And he's like you were saying earlier off the air the other day, you know, Scott, we were talking, earlier a minute ago, he was talking about like Brent Mason's and those guys. It's really cool that they'll say, no, let me take another run at that. That's the way, you know, those great guys do that. Like Eric was doing that. I'm thinking, I love what you just did, you know, they're not happy. They want to go again. He was shaping it like a sculptor. Let me do this. And then every time it just got better and better, you know.
Wow.
So at some point you go, that's awesome. Let's go eat, you know. So.
Yeah. I know this great Thai place.
Now, who's this Ryan Warner character?
I never heard of him.
You know, what was so special about recording
Never heard of him. Nepotism is a great thing, isn't it? I said this in an interview, and I truly do mean it. If he was not my son, he would be one of my favorite guitar players. And, you know, I am prejudiced because he is, but, man, he's really a tremendous player. And I learn from him all the time. He did something the other day I saw him put up a little clip on Instagram and I got it. He's been on the road. I've not seen him for a while. My son, he's my oldest son, but I want to ask him how he did that lick. It's really good. And we're two totally different guitar players. He's a rock and roll kind of a, not so country necessarily as I am. No, he's more of a, I'm a Telecaster guy and he's, a good way to put it is he's more of a Les Paul guy, and I'm a kind of a Telly guy.
Gotcha.
And he's more of Eric Clapton, Eddie Van Halen. He knows all that stuff. And
wow.
So, yeah, I mean, he came in. I told him, I said, Ryan, come up with some kind of cool thing. And if you come up with something, I'd like to maybe have you join me for something on the record. Well, he came in. He took me up on it. He came in with this cool riff that blew me away. And I go, oh, man, that's nice. So, and he did his homework and came in with something to show the teacher here, you know,
yeah.
Hey, Pop, look what I got. So, anyway, he had something really cool, and we cut it and went in with those great players, Willie Weeks and those guys, and Greg Morrow, and cut it. And he's very comfortable in the studio, and he killed it.
That's great. Now, who's he playing with, or what's he doing?
He's kind of a hired gun. Here. Yeah, thanks. I know he'll appreciate it. He's a kind of a hired gun. You know, he's been out through the years. He played with Jewel for a while, and then he toured with Leanne Rimes. And I told him, I said, I see a pattern you with these cute girls. I see what you're doing. You're playing. And then he blew my theory because he went to work for Gary Allen. So, you know,
he's
been out with Gary for the last couple of years, I think. Gary's a cool guy. So he's been out with him, and they're touring.
Very cool. Very cool. Once again, stevewarner.com. His new album is All Over the Map.
Right there.
But that's actually the name of the album.
It actually has a map on it.
It has a map on it.
If you get lost while you're listening to the CD, you know, you're good.
You got somewhere
to refer to.
I never thought of that angle.
It's functional.
He's a CGP and a GPS. So,
Um, we need to take a break. We want to remind you this segment was brought to you by our good friends at Main Street Productions. I had to do a video recently. I had no idea what I was doing.
Yeah.
The whole thing just kind of fell into my lap. Hey, you got to do a video. So, I sat down with Fred. We put this thing together, and I was just so pleased with how quickly we got it done.
Yeah,
how quickly it came back to me. But the process
and how
was,
good it was.
It was. Yeah. It turned out great.
And he's great to work with. And as we were talking about earlier, he understands the songwriter and musician budget very well.
Right.
Which, you know, not everybody has a big huge label behind them to spend $100,000 on a video. You know, some of us have actually real world earthly budgets, and he can work with that and does a great job within that. So
So check him out, mainstreetproductions.org. That is mainstreetproductions.org. We're going to be right back with more of Steve Warner here on the Music Row Show. Stick around.
Welcome back to the Music Row Show. That's a tune called Mr. Roy. That's Steve Warner off his album All Over the Map, but that's actually Steve Warner playing it.
That's my old Rickenbacker Baked Light Lap Steel. My dad is Roy, so that's kind of a little tip of the hat to my pop.
Nice.
And he had, like as I said earlier in the first hour, he had a lot of steel guitars and lap steels laying around. I was very much influenced in that regard by my pop, so it's kind of a little tip of that to him.
Do you play the pedal steel as well?
I play pedal steel too, but this one, what you just heard, is just a lap six steel. String lap steel, no pedals.
Because I've always been just amazed and confounded that somebody can do all those levers and things all at the same time and produce a cool sound out of that, you know, because it's so complicated looking.
Well, you could fly a helicopter, I think, if you can play one of those things, you know. So,
by the way, that's Steve playing the stand-up bass too.
Yep,
wow. I was playing upright bass. Same time.
Yeah. That's what's amazing.
Wow!
I mean,
wow! Wow!
I always thought that song should be in SpongeBob SquarePants. That song.
Yes.
Yeah, when they're
I could see that
in the. So. What's the name of the? Where does he live, guys? Come on,
underwater.
We got a couple of kids here. No, it's the little town he lives in.
I'm embarrassed to say I don't know.
Intern Emmy. Where does SpongeBob live?
Oh,
he lives in
gosh.
I don't know.
That's a good
Bikini
town.
Bikini Bottom. Thank you.
Oh,
thank you, Producer Logan. Right. Hey, Producer Logan.
The biggest kid in the room. There we go.
I love it on that SpongeBob when they're under the water, of course, bear in mind, and it's raining.
It's raining.
They get an umbrella.
Umbrella.
Yeah. I love that. So.
Yeah.
Let's talk about Selectone, because you've been running that for several projects now.
Yeah, I believe this is our fourth or fifth album, I believe. So, yeah.
How was the Selectone learning curve with having your own label? What did you not know you didn't know as an independent when you first got started?
I realized quickly. First of all, I'll say this: with our first release, we've found out very quickly how much record labels do, and we found out quickly this newfound respect we found for record labels that I never really had the whole time I was on a big label, because all of a sudden it's a daunting task that we had in front of us. Like, wow, okay, now it's all on us. But the other side of that coin, it was really nice to be the captain of the ship, so to speak, and have the freedom to do what you want. Mm-hmm. I knew that the times had changed drastically, and it wasn't the same bar that it was. I didn't have to sell the same amounts that I did at that back on the label.
Right.
So, and that gave me a lot of freedom. I say this record All Over the Map, I think music is cooler in a lot of ways these days, especially on these little labels that artists have and so forth. Because of that, the freedom is there to, you hear things
right.
You wouldn't hear that Mr. Roy on a record when I was on MCA. You would not hear that.
Right.
They would not, that record would not happen, this whole record, on the other labels that I was on. I really believe that, because it's all radio driven, and they're not, like you say, instrumentals, not so much. I would get away with one or maybe one on each album. When I was on MCA,
track.
I started that long time ago. I'd do a bonus guitar track, and you know, you just, even then you didn't hear it, but I would just really push the issue. Now you hear it a lot, like Brad Paisley does it.
Sure.
He'll do it at some, and Keith Urban and those guys will do it, you know, but man, we were doing it, you know, 30 years ago, you know, on MCA, and I had to fight my way to do it. You know,
that's,
you had
amazing
to fight them to be able to do it, but you never get away with doing this. And I think that's a good thing for the folks out there, you know, because you're hearing stuff that you wouldn't normally, and look behind the curtain, so to speak, that you wouldn't have.
Yeah. Well, you definitely seem like you're having a lot of fun playing music these days, which is great. Has the business then, I guess, from what you're saying, become more enjoyable for you now than it was back then?
Not really. The music part is not fun to me. I really don't like the business part of it. I love the music part and the creative part, but past that, my wife has always been in the publishing world, and mm-hmm. she's ran our publishing businesses. I started a publishing company in 1976.
Wow.
Steve Warner Music. Everything I've ever written is in that one company. One of
Brilliant.
My early,
that's like right, I've never right
been,
at the beginning. Yeah.
I've never been with another publisher. I've always had Steve Warner Music since 1976.
And do you get along with your publisher?
I get along with her. We sleep together. But yeah, we get along. She's very smart, and if you know, not so much now, she don't really do this, but she used to take classes and do, she'd, if a new rules or laws were coming out, she would go take classes and learn it.
Uh-huh.
And she's backed off from it now. We have people now that help her, you know, that really help her in the publishing world. But there for years and years, she did it all by herself. And as far as even collecting royalties, we didn't even use Harry Fox for years. She did.
Really?
She audited EMI, went out to LA, audited Capitol Records.
Wow.
And, I mean, it's.
Sounds like somebody you don't want to mess with.
What was it? Bill Anderson had a good line. He said, I'd rather have Karen Warner after me with a gun more than a pencil, you know, or something like that. So. But I don't like that part of it. I don't really like the business stuff. I just want to record and write and produce. And
but it's awesome you partnered up with somebody who does like that part.
And you're right. And she'll bring stuff up. She knows that I really don't care for it. I have to be aware of it. Especially when we get into the record label, when we have our record label meetings, so mm-hmm. to speak, we it's always stuff like, oh man, you know, I have to, but you have to do it.
Yeah.
You have mm-hmm. to, you know, it's a necessary part of it to go through all the record label stuff and then the publishing stuff. But luckily she's has always liked that part of it. And my management team now, they're so good at that kind of business stuff that it's a relief. I'm bragging on Rachel sitting over here, but it is a relief to know that you have people around you that really are so capable and are great at what they do. And so that affords me to go off and write a song or whatever. So it's great to have really good people around you. So
You have a show coming up. Did we get any? Did we find any information? It's March 1st.
Yeah. The I'm best excited worst, about this right? show.
Is it it's, the? Is it not the best and the worst? Is it the best and the first or?
The first and the worst.
The first and the worst.
That's I always get that time. I'm sorry. I shouldn't know that coming in here.
Yeah.
But it's at City Winery, and I know it's a lot of cool folks on the show. I know Sonny Curtis is going to be on it, and he's tremendous. And gosh, the other folks, I'm leaving folks out, but it's going to be, it's going to be real good. And it's for a great cause, you know. They and
what it is they bring in all these hit writers and performers.
Yeah, Roseanne Cash.
Oh, Roseanne Cash.
Roseanne. Yeah. And
they play the first song they ever wrote.
And the worst song.
And what they think is the worst song they ever wrote.
In my case, it's all the ones I do.
Oh, come on. Yeah.
No, the first song I ever wrote, I can't do it. I don't even remember it. But I won't mention her name, but I was about 15, and I had a crush on this girl. And so I wrote a song called, this isn't her name, but Brenda. Well, I'll say Brenda.
Mm-hmm.
Here's a catchy title. Brenda, I Need You.
Mm. Ah.
There's a catchy title.
What's that song about?
Do no what? One, don't steal that from me tonight. But I was 15 years old, and I'm so glad I don't remember any of that. So
right now there's a guy in Rhode Island. Who's going, oh, I got it. Brenda.
Nah. Wait a minute. He stole that from me. You know?
My wife is Brenda. Wait a minute. But anyway, that's going to be Roseanne Cash is tremendous. Wow. Sonny Curtis. It's for the, I may get the name wrong because I'm a dumb guy, but it's a Nashville Alliance.
The Health Alliance.
Health Alliance.
Health Alliance,
yeah. Sheila Shipley.
She's been in here before.
Yeah, they're wonderful, all those girls over there and that team. They raise so much great money for such needy causes. And
what they
that's
do
what
is
about.
They help musicians navigate all of the health care, all of the new health care initiatives and everything.
Navigate through all this mess.
Yeah.
That's exactly
they,
right.
They help you get, because
especially because a lot of musicians don't have insurance.
Right.
You know,
you
so
got
they,
that right.
They help them get through it if they have a, you know, some sort of.
And then on a personal note, my niece who's in the music business, she was in the group Those Darlings.
Yeah.
Jessie Darling, that's my niece.
I didn't know that.
Jessie, and she's in the battle of her lifetime right now. She's having a battle with cancer. And this is I know for a fact that they've really been so very helpful navigating and pointing her in the right direction to get her some, the right help and so forth. So it's great, man. And they help so many music biz folks. And I'm tickled and honored to get a chance to get back a little bit and jump up and do a few songs and hang out that night. So it's at City Winery, I think, and it's March 1st. Yep.
And
so please come out.
You can get tickets at citywinery.com.
Yep. Yeah.
Nashville, obviously.
Nashville.
Because there's a lot of them.
Exactly. You know? You're right. Nashville City Winery.
How stupid would I feel if I showed up in New York and be like, I'm here for the show.
Exactly. But that's a wonderful organization they have, and it's great for our industry and for all the musicians and writers and players, and boy, it's what a great resource to have them behind us.
That's awesome.
Well, I'm pulling this up right now, but we still got a little bit of time in this segment. You feel like playing us another song?
Well, gosh, yes. If you don't mind me hearing me tune up here.
Not at all.
Oh, yeah. We prefer that, actually.
So what do we got here?
prefer being in
please,
tune.
Please tune.
March 1st, the first and the worst featuring Roseanne Cash, Sonny Curtis, Frank Rogers, Steve Warner, Peter Cooper.
Yeah, that's right.
And the doors open at 5 o'clock. The show starts at 6:30. Go to citywinery.com/Nashville and get all the pertinent info.
And we've been to previous year's shows, and they are fun. They're fun shows.
Fun.
They are fun. They're so
I've got
fun.
Two words for you.
Two syllables.
Fun. One.
Exactly.
When you told me that you loved me, I believed every single word you said. But then you showed me that you didn't mean it, that you loved somebody else instead. I know you've got a right to change your mind. I've got a right to be losing mine. Where did I go wrong? Where did he go right? I know I'd won the battle If I'd known there was a fight, well, I can't stand the thought of never holding you tight. Where did I go wrong and he go right? There was something all around us like I'd never felt before. I guess I should have seen the warnings, but I was busy coming back for more. I know you've got a right to find someone new. Well, I've got a right to feel this way too. Where did I go wrong? Where did he go right? I know I'd won the battle if I'd known there was a fight. Well, I can't stand the thought of never holding you tight. Where did I go wrong and he go right? Where did I go wrong? Where did he go right? I know I'd won the battle if I'd known there was a fight. Well, I can't stand the thought of never holding you tight. Where did I go wrong and he go right? Well, tell me, where did I go wrong? Tell me, where did he go right? Or tell me, where did I go wrong? Or tell me, where did he go right?
Yeah. That was "Brenda, I Need You" by Steve Warner.
Oh,
wow.
Man. I need to catch my breath. Why don't we take a break? We'll come back with a whole lot more of Steve Warner here on the Music Row Show. Welcome back to the Music Row Show. We're here with Steve Warner. That's a tune off of his latest project called Modulation Situation.
The CD is called All Over the Map.
That's true. And if we'd listened a little longer, we would have gotten to the modulation because it's really cool.
It does it a lot in
it
that
does,
song.
It yeah.
It tops around keys. I couldn't land on one key. I had to kind of...
You couldn't decide.
I couldn't decide.
Yeah.
That's true, man.
It's time to modulate. Quick.
Okay, let's all go up.
So
that song, that particular song, by the way, it's kind of a throwback to 1968. And there was an album that James Burton did with Ralph Mooney. And Chicken Fried or something. I forget the title, but they did one album together. And James Burton, of course, iconic Telecaster guitar
yep.
player, is a dear friend of mine and just a... iconic. I mean, I grew up trying to play like James
just
Burton.
All those little like
chicken picking. They call that little yeah, style yeah. chicken yeah. picking. And yeah. then the steel guitar part was Ralph Mooney was a brilliant steel guitar player. But if you listen for the steel guitar guys, I'm trying to throw in like a little Lloyd Green lick, the best I can do. But Hal Rugg was an awesome steel player. Hal Rugg, Weldon Myrick, Lloyd Green, all those iconic steel players from that era, you know, and John Huey, too. All those guys were just tremendous. So that's a little tip of the hat to all those guys.
You know, speaking of John Huey, of course, we lost him several years ago.
Oh, he was great.
But the past couple of years have been brutal for the country music community as far as Opry heroes and performers, as far as losing several great, great people in the community. Does the sense of responsibility towards the Opry and keeping that flame alive? Has that, as the years go by, does that sense of responsibility grow for you and folks like, you know, Vince and the other guys?
I think a little bit.
Do you talk about it at all?
No, not really, but it's unspoken, but I think it's there, you know. And one day I was hanging out, I'm dropping names here, but I was hanging out with Garth, and we were at his house, and Porter Wagner had just passed, and I said, we were sad. I said, I go, Garth, you know, it's sad that, you know, we lost a great one. Porter's gone. It just, he just passed like 2 days prior. And I said, you know, we're losing all those old great stars at the Opry, you know. And Garth looked at me funny. He goes, we are the old Opry guys.
Yeah.
We're losing all those old Opry guys. He goes, we are those old Opry guys now, you know. And I go, wow, I never looked at it that way. But you know, little Jimmy, you know.
Oh, just, yeah.
All those guys are iconic. And, the, you know, there'll never be another one like, you know, that guy or Grandpa Jones or so many good ones. You know, Jimmy C. Newman was great. And I love Jim Ed Brown. And that's, I cut my teeth playing at the Opry when I was a teenager with Dottie West. And when it was still at the Ryman, we played the Opry, you know.
Right.
And it was a different world then, you know.
What was that first time like at the Opry with Dottie West? And here you are, just a young whippersnapper.
I was 17, and I rode with Dottie to the Opry. She had a white, big white Cadillac. I remember riding in that. I don't even know that I've been in a Cadillac before, to be honest, but I remember riding from Green Hills. She lived on Shies Hill Road on Green Hills, and we rode to the Opry. We went down Belmont. I remember exactly the route we took and went through the Gulch, which was just empty warehouses and junk back then, you know, but and came out down Broadway. And while we were coming, Dottie was notoriously late for a lot of things, and we were coming down Broadway, down the hill there, right by Bridgestone, and we turned left on 5th, and they were introducing, I heard Roy Acuff, if I'm not mistaken, it was Roy Acuff, and he said, here's a young lady from McMinnville, Tennessee, and we're turning out by Tootsie. And I'm like, oh, I've never even been in the building, never even, I'd driven by it a couple times, but, and we've, she comes sliding in the alley, and somebody's running out to grab her, and they rush her in, and I can hear the, on the radio, I can hear the applause starting to die down. And we're just on 5th now. And I'm going like, oh my gosh, where do I go? I grabbed my bass out of the trunk. I was playing bass with Dottie, and somebody rushed her on off. And then I went in behind, and I'm going like, where do I plug in? You know? And they go, over here, come with me. You know? And so, and the applause was already gone. And then, I'm running past Marty Robbins and little Jimmy and all these. I'm like, man, I'm hallucinating. I'm so freaked out, you know. And then next thing I know, we're playing Dottie West songs on the Opry.
Wow.
Like I'm at the Grand Ole Opry, you know. It's
with all that adrenaline pumping, did you end up playing it like 4 times too fast? Or
probably. Honestly, I don't even remember. I was so scared, you know. I don't even remember what we played. Or, but I remember those balconies. They're gone now. But there was the balconies came all the way to the back wall, and you could reach up and there were people like
right there.
You know where the stage now the balcony went. It didn't end there. It went all the way back.
I didn't know
to that back wall. And you could, when you walked off the stage, you had to kind of duck to go underneath that balcony. And you could. That's what freaked me out. There were people like right there. You know, like I'd like shaking somebody's hand. Just it's really cool. You know, and I'm proud that I got a little taste of that era of the Opry and of country music back. That was 73, and it moved, 74, it moved to the big house.
To the new one, yeah.
Yeah, the new place.
We still call it the new one. But
yeah, I do, too. That's funny. I got to tell my guys, I'll say, the new place. It's like, since 74, it's the new
place. Yeah. Oh, that's funny. Well, listen, we're going to take one more break, but we're going to come back with more of Steve Warner here on the Music Row Show, so don't go away. This is a song called Augustine's Dream.
I love this song.
It's a great song. This is the one you were talking about earlier that you just were so excited as you were writing it. You were recording it as you were writing it.
Yeah, pretty much. It was happened all at once. That song, too, you may or may not have read about that, but the title came from my research that my wife Karen did. She's big on the genealogy research and has been before it was chic. She was doing it years ago and studying her family and my family both. But she found that my 5 times maternal great grandfather was named Augustine Lawless, and he was a bombardier in the Continental Army. Of the United States Continental Army of the Revolutionary War.
Wow.
Yeah, which was cool. His name was Augustine Lawless.
What did a bombardier do?
That's what I'm thinking. My bombardier,
I'm thinking airplanes. Yeah.
I guess he blew stuff up.
I'm guessing.
But Revolutionary War, and she found like paperwork, muster rolls and stuff with his signature and his handwriting. It's like Revolutionary War.
How do you find stuff like that? That's amazing.
It gave me chills when I saw his handwriting. It's like, man. And it actually had, I found paperwork on some of his Brandywine. He was in that battle of Brandywine.
Yeah.
And some of those Revolutionary War battles that I don't know much about. But
you've heard about, yeah.
Yeah.
What a name, though. Augustine Lawless.
Did he survive the war?
He did. Okay. He did. And what's funny is I found where he's buried. He and his whole family are buried. And it's in... My brother, Terry, lives in a little town, Jamestown, Kentucky. And just south of there is a little area where my dad and mother are both from that area. In fact, Sawmill Road is in that area where my mom used to live. It's a little area called Sewellton. And he's buried on a farm there, Augustine Lawless and his whole family. Just no markers, but not anything fancy. Mm-hmm. And the guy that owns the farm is a friend of my brother's. So he's buried on his farm. And we found where he's buried. So. I thought that was so cool. I love history. So I named this song after him.
I wonder if he played any instruments.
I would not doubt it. You know, knowing my family, I bet he played something. And probably fiddle.
So speaking of instruments, how do you play so many? How do different instruments inspire you differently? Do you like write this kind of song on that and that kind of song on that?
Or? Usually I have a vision kind of beforehand. Like, you know, I kind of have a little idea of... For example, the Merle Haggard song, I knew that I wanted to be kind of piano-driven, but I thought, well, I want steel guitar, you know. So I had Alan Love that works with me he's worked with me for 30 years, still plays with me, lives in Raleigh, but still tours with me. He came in and played steel on it. But I have a kind of a little vision in my mind, you know, kind of an idea of what I want. And then a lot of times, like on Mr. Roy, for example, I knew I wanted I wanted it to be very fun and just, you know, lilting, you know, kind of like. And so I had an idea of the groove in my head when I was writing it. I kind of had the groove, you know, and I wanted upright bass and I wanted an arch top guitar. I kind of had those ideas, and now the challenge is to make that come out of your head onto tape, you know.
Right.
So and then I knew from the minute I started writing it what instrument I was going to play on it. I've got about 5 lap steels, but I knew it was going to be that Panda. They call those Panda Rickenbacker, the black and white, the little white, those are called Panda guitars, they call them back in the, probably that guitar's probably from the early 40s, you know.
And you knew that was
I knew that was going to be the one I'd play on it. So I already knew before I even wrote the song. I mean, when I wrote the song, I knew that's what I'd play on it. So
that's pretty amazing.
My amp, I played a Fender Princeton amp. I already had in my mind producer.
A vintage one?
Yeah, it's a 65 Princeton. So I already knew I'm going to play this and that. It's like casting characters in a play almost.
That
is
cool. So we talk about this a lot, how there's, you know, there's thousands of people that come to this town, tens of thousands. And in any given time, Belmont says something like 50, 60,000 people here trying to do this in some capacity. Hundreds come in every week. Hundreds leave every week. You are one of those few that had this amazing, you know, you had a run longer than most as far as the radio hits and the record sales and the deals. Is a musical life more enjoyable after that whirlwind is over? I mean, are you able to really enjoy and soak things in more now than you were able to?
Well, to answer you, I think I'm actually playing better now than I did when I was having big hits. I think I'm writing better and playing better. I don't, maybe singing better too. I don't know, but
I was saying,
I think my playing is better. That's crazy to say that, but I think I was so busy at the time touring and, You know, I was so busy one time that Jimmy Bowen called me for a session. He said, "We're going to start your new record." And I said, "Man, I'm going to be in Cincinnati that night." And he kind of got mad. He goes, "Would you want to, okay, we won't make a record then." If that's, I'm like, "Well, wait a minute." He goes, "No, if you rather go," like, wow, you know, we were going so much. So, I mean, I think I was so caught up in all of it at the time, you know, and I had my first hit was in 1979. Mm-hmm. And then the last radio hit that I had, like really was on radio, was probably like 2001. So I went from 79 to 2001 having radio hits.
Yeah.
And so that's a pretty good stretch, you know, of really being on the radio, you know.
Was that last one with Anita?
Well, if you count that one, I was counting I'm Already Taken. That maybe I need to look that up. Actually, that was a number one with Anita. That was her record.
Yeah,
I count that as hers. But that was that was around 2000. I definitely I remember being there, and I remember going, why did they not do these tracks a little bit in a lower key? I have no choice. I have to make this happen. Yeah. The tracks are already cut,
probably,
folks.
Before Pro Tools, where they could just go, you know, click, click. Okay, here's a different key.
Yeah,
for
they
you.
Were probably doing it a little bit, but maybe they helped me. I don't know. But, man, that was high. And I was like, now these tracks are already done, right? So, but that was a great record. Anita is wonderful. And I was honored she asked me to be a part. But I'm lucky to have got in on a lot of stuff for a long time. You know, that longevity is, you know, I don't know. It's maybe you'll see it again, but I mean, that's a different era. You know, that's a long time to be on radio, you know, and I'm grateful. So
awesome. We're grateful that you were here for 2 hours with us.
Man,
so thank you very
pleasure.
Much.
All Thanks Over the Map is the name of the CD. Steve Warner, go get it at stevewarner.com or iTunes or Amazon or anywhere great music is sold.
Buy his Valentine's Day bundle
there
right now.
Oh, I saw
Valentine's
that. Yeah.
Day bundle.
We had some fun for the weekend.
All right. Thanks for listening to the Music Row Show. We'll see you next time.
Bye-bye, guys.